Ave listeners, a quick notice before we commence this episode. For the first time ever, we are doing a survey. Rhiannon Evans, Kaylin Davenport, and myself are doing a spot of research on history podcasts in their audience, and we could use your help. The best way to find the survey is to look on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page or look on our Twitter feed at Rome Podcast. It'll just take a few minutes of your time, and thanks. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaylin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt. This is episode CXLVIII, the always unpredictable outcome of war. The Civil War of 238 CE outdoes all others, with no less than six acknowledged emperors vying for the purple. By the time the dust settles on this episode, there'll be one man left standing. One child left standing. And clearly he'll be the best man slash child for the job. Here's Kaylin Davenport.
Gordian I and Gordian II were two senators. They were sort of blue bloods, the exact opposite of Maximinus, the general who had been campaigning on the frontiers. So when news reached the Senate in Rome that their new champions had actually been defeated by Capellianus and had been executed, the Senate decided that they needed new champions to take their cause up against Maximinus.
Did they decide that right away, or did they actually discuss, should we go back to Maximinus and apologise with open arms?
There's discussion either in the Temple of Concord or in the Temple of Jupiter, probably in late January or early February of 238, and they actually decide to form a senatorial committee. 20 senators are elected to lead the resistance against Maximinus. This is a unique act of senatorial decisiveness against an emperor whom they have outlawed. So we know from inscriptions that these senators had the title of Vigintuiri ex Senatus Consulto Re Publicae Curandi, the 20 men assembled by decree of the Senate to protect the state, protect the state against Maximinus.
And when you say we know about that from inscriptions, is this on some of their tombs or something?
On their statue bases that record their careers, which is a wonderful insight, because Herodian kind of glosses over the Vigintuiri, the 20 men. The HA is actually quite well informed about them.
Yeah.
And we know from, accounts of their careers. Mm. So out of the 20, they elected two senators to serve as joint Augusti, as joint emperors. And these were Marcus Clodius Pupienus Maximus and Decimus Caelius Calvinus Balbinus. So in this new imperial college, Pupienus's name always comes first, despite the fact that Balbinus was older and had held his second consulship much earlier. So Balbinus had been consul for the second time under Caracalla, whereas Pupienus had only been consul for the second time under Severus Alexander.
And we know of Pupienus by a different name, Maximus, in the historical sources?
Yes. So the Historia Augusta calls it the Lives of Maximus and Balbinus. So MB for short, we call it. We know that he was from a senatorial family. His sons were senators as well. It may be the fact that Pupienus was urban prefect, which might have made him more senior between the two men, even though Balbinus was considerably older. And interestingly, both senators were jointly Pontifex Maximus, the first time this had ever happened in Roman history. They have the titles of Pater Patriae, both of them, and Pater Senatus, Father of the Senate. and the coins that are minted for them, you know, they're not related in any way. So these are two men brought together by the forces of circumstances. So their coins proclaim their mutual love, their mutual admiration for each other. You know, there are scenes of clasped hands. The idea is with these two men at the helm of the state and the senatorial board behind them that they can defeat Maximinus.
So why did the Senate choose these two men in particular? I assume that they had qualities that they thought that a leader should have, but at the same time, they can do checks and balances on each other.
Exactly. They both had long senatorial careers. Pupienus Maximus had held army commands. He'd govern Germany and Asia. He is portrayed as the military man in comparison to Balbinus. The ages given in the ancient sources are very confused. So the ages that we get from Zonarus has Pupienus as much older, being 74, Balbinus being younger, about 60. It's actually much more logical that the ages were reversed, given their careers, and that Pupienus had only been recently consul for the second time. So they're older men, you know, we're going back to the ideas of someone like a Pertinax or a Nerva, experienced hands at the tiller. The ancient sources, you know, very much promote the idea that Pupienus would lead the army, Balbinus would stay behind and manage Rome and the administration.
Right, because you've got a much more thoughtful person. You've got one person who's military, one who's the might, and the other who's better at bookkeeping, I suppose. I don't want to downplay his skill set or anything like that, but, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is something that comes up in both H.A. and the Historia Augusta and Herodian, the idea that two emperors are better than one. And even if they're not related at all, that they can actually manage the state because they have all the skills between them.
The Senate must be pretty happy with their idea, and I think it's something that they can put up as a challenge to Maximinus. But how do the people of Rome take this to be greeted with their fourth and fifth emperor for the year?
Yes. Well, they don't take very kindly towards this. There's revolts in the streets of Rome. They particularly don't like Pupienus, who's supposed to have been a harsh urban prefect. And according to Herodian, they demand that Gordian I's grandson by his daughter, the 13-year-old boy, Marcus Antonius Gordianus, be made Caesar. Now, this is really interesting. It's quite likely that the forces behind this call for this 13-year-old boy to be made an emperor may well have been senatorial associates of Gordian I and Gordian II, relatives. Perhaps they were locked out of the Wiginteriri. They felt they had been marginalized. They thought that a youth would allow them to be the power behind the throne. So it may not be an entirely popular revolt. But what happens is, because of the popular discontent, is that the Senate decrees that Marcus Antonius Gordianus should join the Imperial College as Caesar, so junior to Pupienus and Balbinus.
So not emperor yet.
Not emperor. He's only a Caesar, but he's part of the Imperial College. You know, coins are minted showing all three of them distributing largesse to the people there.
That's a crowded coin.
It is a crowded coin.
I've got to look that up.
And it's a bizarre kind of Imperial College that's put together by three people who weren't related.
Yeah.
You know, Gordon III, you know, is a grandson of a deceased emperor. It's a very political triumvirate that have come together. And we're still only, you know, in late January or early February there. So the Senate is really having to take action here.
So despite getting, it seems, what they want by Gordian III being elevated as well as a Caesar, Rome doesn't react well to all this tumultuous activity.
Yes, so there seems to be a revolt by the Praetorian Guard at this time. You may remember that their prefect, Vitalianus, Maximinus's man, has been murdered. They also seem to be unhappy with Pupienus and Balbinus. And there's actually a riot between the people of Rome and Praetorian Guards. There's a fire which breaks out. Herodian says in 7.12.7, a great many people died in the fire. All the property of the wealthy was looted when the criminal and worthless elements in the city joined with the soldiers in plundering, and the part of Rome destroyed by fire was greater in extent than the largest intact city in the empire. Now, I'm sure that's an exaggeration, but the fact is that there is internal turmoil in Rome. The changeover of emperors is prompting civil and military instability. So the Praetorian Guard makes their way into the Senate House, and Herodian tells us in 7:11, 3-4, that one of the senators, a Carthaginian called Gallicanus, who had recently held the consulship, and another of Praetorian rank called Maecenas, without any warning, while the soldiers had their hands under their cloaks, stabbed them in the heart with daggers they were carrying under the folds of their clothing. Because of the rioting and unrest, everyone was carrying daggers, some openly and others secretly, alleging this was a protection against the sudden, treacherous attacks of their enemies. So on this occasion, the soldiers were fatally wounded while off their guard, without a chance to defend themselves, and lay there at the foot of the altar of victory, the Senate House. So, you know, the Senate was not a building you were supposed to enter armed. So this shows the fear at the time.
So how does Maximinus react to this? We've heard that he's marching to Rome in the previous episode.
Yes.
And essentially, Herodian does kind of repeat what he said in the previous book, I think, with a bit more detail.
Yes. So Maximinus is marching from the Danubian frontier, and he reaches North Italy in about April of 238 and inspires terror in the city of Emona in northeast Italy. And Herodian says in 8.1.5, Maximinus was gratified by the immediate flight of these Italians, and now anticipated that all the people of Italy would flee at his approach. But the army was by no means pleased to find itself suffering from famine at the very outset. So there are problems because he can't supply his army properly. They're moving very quickly down to Italy. And the Senate has a plan. Again, this is really quite remarkable. So Balbinus remains in Rome. Pupienus takes the field. And we know from inscriptions that other leading senators amongst the Wiginteweri, the Board of 20, are sent to take control of other regions of Italy. And these include really quite distinguished men, Caesonius Lucullus Macro Rufinianus, who's the son of one of Severus Alexander's advisors, Valerius Claudius Achilleus Priscillianus, who is a patrician, was ordinary consul under Severus Alexander. Blue bloods, much like Gordian I and Gordian II.
It's who's who of the Senate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're all coming together to defend Italy. We know from another inscription that a senator called Annianus was in charge of recruiting young men and preparing arms at Milan and North Italy. So they're all being mobilized there against Maximinus.
And really what they're facing down is the bulk of the army, though, that's marching towards them.
Exactly. And that's why they need to recruit new troops from Italy itself.
Wow. So, it's making it sound very desperate. So
yes. Well, I mean, the Legio II Parthica, the one legion stationed in Italy, normally at Albanum, is, of course, with Maximinus because that is the legion that goes with the emperor on his campaigns.
Yeah,
they don't
yeah.
have that to turn to. But there's going to be a showdown between the two forces at Aquileia.
So where's that?
So this is in northeast Italy, a major port on the northern end of the Adriatic Sea. It's quite close to Venice. Today you can take the train from Venice to Aquileia. It's a wonderful site to visit. It's very undervisited, even though it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site there. So you can see some of the remains of the harbour. You can also see the wonderful mosaics in one of the first Christian churches built in the time of Constantine a bit later. It has a fantastic museum collection there as well. And you know, this had been a major staging post for emperors from the time of the 2nd century AD. This is where Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus had wintered on their way up to the Danubian front, and Verus dies there shortly afterwards.
Mm, yep.
And so it's a big city. You know, its population probably between 50 and 100 100,000 at this time.
Yeah.
So it's a major staging post. And this is where the two forces are going to face off.
Maximinus is marching his troops there, not really anticipating there being too much of a challenge. It sounds like he's actually expecting to be able to stroll into Rome at the head of a big army.
Exactly. But the people of Aquileia mount a resistance. So they repair the wall, Herodian tells us, fortifying the city. They're well provisioned for a siege, and they're assisted by two members of the senatorial quinquiri, Rutilius Pudens Crispinus and Tullius Menophilus. Once again, we know about their careers from inscriptions and some other later Greek sources as well. So Maximinus is understandably not very happy that the city is choosing to resist him. He sends envoys demanding the surrender of Aquileia, saying that it would be razed to its foundations, whereas Crispinus, the senator, convinces them to resist. He tells them not to trust the promises of a tyrant, a liar and a hypocrite, and not to surrender to certain destruction, lulled by soft words when they could put their trust in the always unpredictable outcome of war. So don't give in, you know, war can go any way. So, you know, Maximinus is coming with this army.
That's not a great argument.
Well, actually, it features very often in Greco-Roman historiography that, you know, if you trust yourself to war, you know, there could be unpredictable things that could happen. It's used both ways, interestingly.
So this isn't going to be an easy siege for Maximinus and his troops because they've got a wall confronting them. They've got hostile environment to have troops stationed with, and they aren't well provisioned. And this is all stuff that Herodian's emphasized in his text. So what does he tell us about the siege and how it goes about?
It's a wonderful description. Herodian's a great writer. He's a great read. So Herodian says, and here I'm taking it from 8.4.8 onwards, Maximinus and Maximus thought that if they did not demolish this, the first city in Italy to oppose them, they could not decently make their triumphant march on Rome.
Mm.
And the Aquileians, Herodian continues, fired down rocks from the walls and prepared a concoction of pitch and oil mixed with sulfur and bitumen, which they poured into empty jars with long handles. As soon as the army approached the walls, they set fire to the mixture and poured it out, showering it all together like rain on the besiegers. The pitch mixed with the other ingredients when poured out penetrated through the exposed parts of the body and spread all over the person. Men tore off their burning breastplates and other armour because the metal was getting red hot, and the leather and wooden parts were burning and shrinking. And so one had the spectacle of soldiers who had actually stripped themselves, and of weapons that had been abandoned, looking like spoils of war, and all this achieved not by military prowess, but by scientific skill. As a result of this incident, a great number of soldiers lost their eyesight, or their faces and hands and any other exposed parts of their bodies were disfigured.
This sounds brutal. The army of Maximinus get depressed.
Understandably so.
I would just go, screw it. This is not worth it.
It's quite disastrous for Maximinus because Maximinus's forces have been cut off from the rest of Italy. So they're besieging Aquileia, and the senatorial quinquiri have blocked land and sea routes. So the army has no shelter, it's hungry, the river nearby is full of blood and bodies. Herodian says that the besieging army is actually being besieged itself. So morale is at a low point.
Mm.
And this prompts the soldiers of the second Parthian legion, this legion which travels with the emperor, to kill Maximinus and his son Maximus to end the siege.
Now, in some respects, I'm there going, well, it doesn't take much for them to turn against their commanding officer if things aren't going their way. But at the same time, yay for Rome.
Yes, I mean, the army decides to take matters into their own hands. You know, this is a pattern we've seen throughout these episodes dealing with Maximinus there. It's quite similar, actually, to the way in which Gordian is actually acclaimed emperor. So Herodian provides a story where he says in 8.5.8, Maximinus was resting in his quarters where there was a break in the fighting that day.
Yeah, okay.
So it's, you know, quite similar to Gordian sitting on his couch there. Suddenly, the soldiers from the camp at Mount Alba near Rome, so this is the Legio II Parthica, decided to murder Maximinus so they could abandon the long, interminable siege and stop laying waste to Italy for the benefit of a tyrant who was condemned and hated. With great daring, the men went to Maximinus's tent about midday and tore down his portraits from the standards with the assistance of the bodyguards. When Maximinus and his son came out of their hut to try and negotiate, the soldiers killed them without listening. The military prefect was also killed, and all Maximinus's close advisers. The bodies were thrown out for anyone to desecrate and trample on before being left to be torn to pieces by dogs and birds. The heads of Maximinus and his son were sent to Rome.
Mm. So that ends the siege. Mm. I guess the army is at this point declaring themselves for Rome against the barbarian ruler.
Exactly.
But I'm just amazed. Well, I guess they don't have any other option, but all is forgiven really quickly.
Yep. So the people of Aquileia bring out pictures of Pupienus Balbinus and Gordian III wreathed in laurel. The army goes over to, you know, the senatorial faction. Pupienus arrives in Aquileia, where he's feted and celebrated. The heads of Maximinus and Maximus arrive in Rome. Balbinus is there to receive them. He sacrifices. There's celebrations in the street in Rome as well. And it's interesting that there's a coin of Maximinus, a bronze coin, which has been defaced. So the obverse has actually been chiseled or tooled to make his head actually on a pike, as it would have been in Rome. And there's actually like a worm or a weevil going into his head as well. So that people actually, you know, doctored coins to celebrate the death of Maximinus and that his head was on a pike.
That's so essentially graffiti, but I like
it.
It is. Yeah. Two things I want to point out here. Hey, Maximinus returned to Rome.
Yeah, he did. He got there.
He got there. I can't help but think that they're reinforcing bad behavior when it comes to the military. Mm. We're going to up your pay each time we declare a new emperor. While you back us, you are friends. As soon as you kill us, you are friends of the other people. Yeah, you can really tell who holds the power in Rome now. Mm. It's just the military.
Yes, and if we look at what's going on here, we have soldiers that must have fought for multiple sides during these civil wars, fight one emperor, then go on to the other side. And soldiers were also used as sort of tools in this ongoing war between emperors. There's an inscription which talks about a vexillation of soldiers that's actually sent. The inscription says, to erase the name of the most savage tyrant. It's been suggested that Maximinus could be that emperor or one of the other emperors of the 3rd century, but the soldiers are being used to actually go out and erase names of opponents. They're both dictating what's happening, but also the playthings of emperors as well.
I like how it doesn't specify the name. It's just of the savage tyrant.
Exactly.
Which savage tyrant? Well, ask us tomorrow and we'll see who it is then.
Exactly. No, it would be dangerous to put the name in. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And it's interesting, Pupienus actually delivers an address to the troops. So this is a way of sort of healing the wounds. So outside the walls of Aquileia, he says, there's two emperors, Pupienus, myself, and Balbinus. You know, between the two of us, we can control Rome, the frontiers. As Maximinus' soldiers, you were just obeying orders. That's okay. It's a speech which tries to heal the wounds and provide a new vision for leadership with Pupienus and Balbinus at the head of the Res Publica, the Roman state.
Thus ends the reign of Maximinus Thrax, and I'll be saying that a couple more times this episode. The barbarian is gone. Rome breathes a sigh of relief, for a couple of months.
Once the spectre of Maximinus is gone, the triumvirate of Pupienus, Balbinus, and Gordian III actually doesn't last very long. There are a couple of reasons for this. The first one is that the Praetorians are unhappy with Pupienus and Balbinus.
Mm.
They resent the fact that Pupienus has brought German troops back to the capital. Pupienus had been a governor of Germany and he'd won the loyalty of his troops then. And we know that they hadn't been in favour of Pupienus and Balbinus from the beginning. But there's also disquiet between the two emperors themselves. Balbinus thought that he should be, you know, the most senior emperor because he had been consul twice, he was a patrician. Pupienus thought that he should be the senior emperor because he had been urban prefect. So matters come to a head at the Capitoline Games. This is in May of 238. And Herodian paints a very detailed picture of the crisis which erupts at the games. During the Capitoline Games, we're told that the Praetorian Guard rushed into the palace. Pupienus and Balbinus are arguing what to do, and as they do so, the guards at the entrance to the palace abandon their posts. And Herodian says in 8.8.6, "The two old men were seized, stripped of the simple clothes they had on for indoor wear, and dragged naked from the imperial palace to the accompaniment of absolutely degrading indignities. After beating and jeering at the senatorial emperors, the Praetorians maltreated them by pulling out their beards and eyebrows and mutilating their bodies before dragging them through the city to the camp. They were not even prepared to kill them into the palace. Instead, they wanted to torture them alive so they would feel their agony longer. As the Germans heard the news, they collected their weapons and rushed to the aid of the two men. But after Praetorians were informed of their approach, they murdered the emperors, whose bodies were by now totally mutilated. Their bodies were left exposed out on the road, while the soldiers lifted up Gordian, who held the title of Caesar, and proclaimed him as the emperor for want of someone else at this stage."
So that's two things. One is that they can just brazenly assume and apparently do get away with doing that to the emperor.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not even a knife in the back. It is complete humiliation.
Exactly,
It's desecration. It's just... Even for Rome, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah, this is one of the worst imperial deaths that we have seen. You know, it's not a quick beheading. It's, you know, dragged through the streets naked, their beards pulled out. You know, this is what the Praetorian Guard can do when they resolve in a course of action.
Now, I don't think that we got as much detail, but Elagabalus might have had a very similar
Yes. So he was already in the Praetorian camp when he's killed.
Yeah. But also dragged throughout Rome with his mother.
Exactly. Now, we don't get as much detail there. But yes, no, I think the idea of, you know, doing violence to the emperor's bodies if they're being overthrown, if they're hated by the Praetorians.
It's a bit cathartic.
It is, yeah. It's a way of, you know, taking out your anger and your frustration.
Maybe take up a hobby, guys.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, the Germans give up the fight, elevate Gordian III.
Now, do you think that that was always the plan? Or do you think that they've gone, well, if we say that we did it in the name of the Caesar, we're doing it for the people of Rome?
Yes. I mean, the way that Herodian portrays it is that, you know, he's there, he's already Caesar, he's only 13.
He's a sock puppet.
Yeah, what's he going to say?
Mm.
It's interesting. The Greek sources, the later Greek sources, Zosimus and Zonaras, have a different tradition that Pupienus and Balbinus had been plotting to get rid of the young Gordian III, and that this had prompted the soldiers' revolt. Now, it is quite plausible that these two senators didn't want this young boy foisted upon them, perhaps by another faction within the Senate, but we don't really know the full story. I mean, certainly a young boy is going to be easier to control than the two older men, both experienced generals. Herodian's history ends on a... It's difficult to read the note on which it ends. Is it somber? Is it hopeful? Herodian says 8.8.8. This was the end of Maximus and Balbinus, a death that was undeserved and desecrated for two respected and distinguished old men who had come to power through their high birth and by their own merits. Gordian, aged about 13, was saluted as emperor and took over the Roman Empire. And that's it.
Yeah.
This is a history from the death of Marcus Aurelius. So this has led scholars to wonder, you know, how much can we read into this? Is this a dun-dun-dun? You know, Herodian doesn't have a good attitude towards young emperors. So he's been critical of, you know, Caracalla, Geta, Commodus, Elagabalus. So is this a note of foreboding? Or is it a note of hopefulness? Or is it a note of resignation that, you know, there'll always be another emperor? These two men have been killed. Now we have this one. The cycle, the turnover of emperors and usurpers is going to continue. And I wonder if that's the note that Herodian is leaving for us.
It's now May/June, around that time of 238.
Yes.
And we've had six emperors in that amount of time, or six people given the title of emperor. Does Rome really think that they're heading into a time of peace now? Because when you think about it, this was the year of the six emperors, and the year of the five emperors was 193.
Yes.
About 45 years earlier, so within living memory.
Definitely.
So Rome wouldn't be fooling itself.
No, I mean, this is something that has happened before. This is 6 months into the year. I mean, northern Italy has been devastated. There's been a revolt in North Africa. And now they have a 13-year-old boy.
Another child emperor.
Another child emperor. In that way, he's seen as a safe choice for the soldiers. I mean, this is what Herodian says. You know, he's there. You know, why not acclaim him emperor? And it is a stable reign. He does rule from 238 to 244. And, you know, when we talk about that, we'll talk about the people who helped him. You know, he doesn't rule alone. There's a very powerful Praetorian prefect. But Rome does actually come out on top again with Gordian III. And it's actually going to be problems in Persia that are going to bring down his reign, not internal dissent.
We could have very easily, at any point at the end of these emperors, say, you know, go back to Commodus all the way through the Severans. Whenever a Roman emperor died, you could have said, and then the Roman Empire ended.
Yes.
The fact that it continues through what we call the crisis of the third century and seems to come out the other end, and you are still talking about the Roman Empire at that point, is quite amazing that it can survive this kind of turmoil.
Exactly. I think this is one of the most important points about the third century is that we talk about crisis and all the problems, but we should also be asking why it lasted so long, why it endured these problems. And this is because there was a belief in Rome and the Roman imperial system and an attachment to it amongst the provincials that transcended any one individual emperor and their personalities. In a way, for many Romans, it didn't matter who the emperor was as long as there was an emperor.
That's Dr. Calen Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Calen on Twitter. Calen is at Dr. C. Davenport. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we will close the book on the historian Herodian. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.